Let's cultivate our motivation. So we're really quite fortunate to have met the Buddha Dharma, and if I may say so, especially the Tibetan tradition, where the teachings are explained very clearly and where the whole practice of doing the three things, hearing, reflecting, and meditating on the teachings is practiced, is done. And I think especially to have access to the mind training teachings from the Kadampa tradition that became later, influenced the later new translation schools. So those teachings on the mind training are really precious, how to transform adversity into the path, how to keep our mind in the Dharma, whether we have happiness or suffering, how to practice in daily life, and to transform small daily life actions into the path. So these kind of very practical teachings are explained in the mind training tradition. And we're very fortunate to have encountered that. So why we have a chance to practice, why we have the chance to learn the teachings, let's really put our heart and our mind into it and have a very far-reaching intention that aspires for full awakening so that we can be of the greatest service to each and every living being. So generate that intention. Okay, so we're towards the end of the chapter that's called Making Progress. And so this chapter, it talked about realistic expectations, okay, at doing advanced practices at the right time, not jumping into them right away. And now we're at the section called Checking Our Meditation Experiences. And this is the last section in this particular chapter called Making Progress. So His Holiness says, some students talk of having extraordinary meditative experiences, but when something upsetting happens in life, they are unprepared and cannot handle it. Is that anybody here? This usually occurs because they have overestimated their meditative experiences. There's a book that came out some years ago. What was it called? After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. And it was telling stories mostly of insight meditation practitioners who had extraordinary experiences, and then when they had to do things in daily life, they were getting angry and confused, and you know, and they were wondering, they thought, oh, I had achieved something so wonderful, and now, like, my mind's a mess, I can't concentrate. Yeah. So His Holiness says this usually occurs because they've overestimated their meditative experiences. Okay, unusual experiences such as visual appearances, special dreams, or feelings of bliss are not necessarily indications of spiritual realizations. Sorry to disappoint you. Okay, they may occur due to an imbalance of the winds, the prana or the chi, then you have different appearances, different sensations in your body, but it's just an imbalance of the prana. It may have to do with external interferences or an overactive imagination. For this reason, it is important to consult our spiritual mentors who will help us evaluate these experiences. So some years ago, there was one man who was doing a lot of meditation, and he told me, that he, when he would go to bed at night after, in the middle of retreat, then sometimes he would just feel this incredible bliss in his body would like arch, as he lay down on the bed experiencing this bliss. And he said to me, he asked me, what's going on? And, is this the bliss and emptiness? And, am I melting the drops and the energies flowing in the channels? And so I said, well, I don't know, but let me ask one of my teachers. So I phoned one of my teachers who lives in the U.S., and I described the situation to him. And Geshe-la's response was, it's just sexual energy. he was quite disappointed. Yeah, but that's what it was. Okay. So some experiences, such as having premonitions of future events, arise due to karma. They are not always accurate, okay? And not everyone will welcome a prediction of future illness when they haven't asked us for advice. Okay, so even if you have this kind of ability, don't go around telling people if they haven't asked you. Unusual or exotic forms may appear when we're meditating, or we may experience strange sensations in our body. Most of these are distractions and should be ignored. One of my friends was telling me he was doing a mindfulness meditation, Buddhist mindfulness, I think, or shamatha meditation, I can't remember. But he had a very bad pain in this shoulder. And then it jumped to this shoulder, it's just like that. And this shoulder was okay. And then this shoulder, was hurting. And I remember when I first was learning meditation, I had gone to a three-week course by Lama and Rinpoche, and I came back, and I was exploring everything, and I went to, there was some other, something at some kind of someplace, this was the 60s, the 70s, it was the 70s, so I went, and these people were doing some kind of practice where, the spirit arose in you and you fell back and people caught you. I went to this place and all these people were doing that. I didn't do it, But the next day when I was sitting and, trying, I would just been, met the Dharma like 3-4 weeks ago. So I was just sitting there and then meditating and then I'm falling back. You know, what is it? Why am I falling back? You know, nothing like the power of suggestion. Okay. So, and, you know, I don't know about you, but I can close my eyes. I can see colors, kaleidoscope things. I can have faces, incredible faces, just appear to me. I close my eyes and lots of faces appear. It's all just garbage. You know, there is absolutely nothing fantastic about any of that. You know, if I pay attention to it, oh, this face and that face, and look at these colors. And well, so what? Does that get me any closer to awakening? Does it make me a kinder person? Does it make me a more ethical person? You know, it's just garbage. Okay? So most of these are distractions and should be ignored. Once, His Holiness says, I met a Westerner who considered himself a tantric practitioner. In a hopeful voice, he told me of a dream in which he saw many deities and related it to the passage in Chandrakirti's supplement, The Middle Way, that says, quote, at that time you will see 100 Buddhas, which refers to a bodhisattva on the path of seeing who has direct perception of emptiness. This person, this Western man, thought that because he dreamed of many deities, he must be an Arya bodhisattva and waited for me to confirm that. I replied, seeing 100 Buddhas is not the only quality of bodhisattvas on the path of seeing. They have many other qualities as well. They can live 100 eons and emanate 100 manifestations. So examine whether you can do these as well. Okay. There was also one man who was, the way he taught, he very strongly hinted that he had direct realization of emptiness. Okay. And, you know, that he was practicing Tantra and had some kind of special powers and all. And one of my teachers, you know, there was a little bit, he was quite a controversial teacher in the Buddhist world. And so at one point, somebody asked one of my teachers about him. And Rinpoche wrote him a letter that said, well, the real tantric practitioners, like Galangma Palmo, she was one Indian nun who was the lineage, head lineage lama for the Nune practice of Thousand Arm Chenrezig. He said, Gelongma Palmo, when people didn't believe that she had realizations, she cut off her head and then reattached it. And then people believed that she had realizations. So could you do that as well? Yeah, there. I don't think there was a reply to that. Okay. So remaining humble, His Holiness says, is an essential quality for genuine spiritual practitioners. A disingenuous person may praise himself or disparage others due to attachment to receiving offerings, fame, or status. Okay, which, by the way, is a root transgression of the first root bodhisattva vow. Okay. Boasting of one's achievements. And in terms of monastic vows, if you lie about achievements, realizations, then it's a root transgression that you lose your ordination. If you don't, if you're lying, you don't actually have those. If you do have them, and you happen to mention it to another monastic, then it's a lapse. It's also a transgression. Yeah, so we're not supposed to talk about these things unless there's really some reason to do it that would really help somebody in their practice. Yeah. So I always tell people, you know, if you meet somebody who is proclaiming all sorts of realizations, hang on to your wallet. Okay? There, you know, there's always, you know, I don't know, people mailed me these things. You know, there was some years ago, there was Maitreya Buddha in California, you know, who collected a great deal of money. There was Dorji Chong the third, you know, we got a big, thick book describing all of his things. You know, so there's lots of this stuff. Yeah. And hold on to your wallet. The people, you know, at least in my experience, that I respect the most are the people who are very humble. Yeah. I mean, look at like at his holiness, you know, he's known in the Tibetan community as being the manifestation of the Buddha of compassion, Chenrezig. And people run up to his holiness, "Are you really Chenrezig?" You know, and his holiness says, "I'm just a simple Buddhist monk." That's all. He doesn't go, "Oh, I'm Chenrezig. Oh, I'm the Dalai Lama. And put your offerings here." Yeah, he doesn't do that. He's just completely, humble. Another one of my teachers, Geshe Leshi Topden, many of you have heard me speak of him. He passed away many years ago now, but lived up in the mountains up above Dharamsala and did retreat there. And His Holiness asked him to come to Italy to teach. He did not want to go. Yeah, but His Holiness was his teacher, so he left retreat and he came to Italy. And I was living in Italy at the Dharma Center at that time. And, you know, out of respect for our teacher, we made a nice big throne for him. And I remember the first day he came in to teach, he looked at the throne, he took the cushion that was on top of it, put it on the ground, and sat on the cushion on the ground. And then he taught. He was in the Villetta. We had china, you know, this incredible, you know, beautiful Italian china. And he went in there and he said, "Get rid of this stuff and give me plastic plates." When he lived in Dharamsala, he would walk around the korwa, the long korwa there. And his shemdap was always a little bit raggedy and kind of hiked up. And he had old socks on and these really scuffed up brown shoes. And his socks were falling down. And he had whiskers, you know, that was sticking out. And he would just walk, you know, do his korwa and say his mantra. And, you know, everybody who was younger would try and, you know, go in front of him because he wasn't fast enough. And but he was a real yogi. Didn't show anything. Yeah. Even his attendant who brought him food every week for a year told me he never saw Geshe Leshi's tantric implements, and he never even saw the picture of the deity he was meditating on. I mean, Geshe Leshi was just completely, you know, like under the radar. And, you know, that's, I think, why he was a great meditator and why His Holiness chose him to go to Italy, you know. In Italy, you know, everybody wants to be somebody. And he chose this monk to go who didn't want to be anybody at all. Okay, so we should not be a ingenuous person may praise himself or disparage others due to attachment to receiving offerings, fame, or status. We should not be led astray by this. The Buddha describes several ways to differentiate a true from an untrue person. So here's a quote from the Majjhima Nikaya. But a true person considers thus, it is not because of one's renown that states of greed, hatred, or confusion are destroyed. So it's not a good reputation that gets rid of your afflictions. Even though someone may not be well known and famous, yet if he has entered upon the way that accords with the Dharma, entered upon the proper way, and conducts himself according to the Dharma, he should be honored for that. He should be praised for that. Yeah, so for practicing the way the Buddha taught. Yeah. So putting the practice of the way first, he neither lauds himself nor disparages others because of his renown. The Buddha spoke similarly regarding true persons who do not laud themselves and disparage others due to their family socioeconomic status or how many offerings they receive, how ascetic they are, how strictly they keep their precepts, or what level of samadhi they have attained. Okay, so the Buddha spoke similarly for all these people who boasted because of any of these kind of characteristics. The Mahayana mind training texts emphasize the same points. Okay, so one of the phrases in the seven-point mind training, do not be boastful. And another is, do not turn a god into a devil. By using dharmic practice to increase our self-centered attitude and self-grasping ignorance. So the god is the dharma practice, and then we use it just to, you know, become arrogant and boast to people. So that's like turning a god into a devil. One Tibetan meditator had a vision of Tara in retreat. His student became very excited upon hearing this, but the meditator remained nonplussed. Puzzled, the student asked why, to which the meditator replied, whether or not Tara actually appeared to me, I need to continue to practice. Realizing emptiness with the subtle mind is what will actually free me. So he wasn't at all impressed with his vision of Tara. Dreams are illusory, although sometimes they may indicate future occurrences. I have met Tibetans who dreamed of Dharamsala before they came here, and some people dreamed of being at temples before having gone there. However, attachment to dreams increases grasping at true existence, which leads to obstacles. So it's important to remember that dreams are empty of true existence. When we face obstacles due to sentient beings, meditation on compassion is best. But when we encounter other obstacles, meditation on emptiness is the best attitude. Okay, so there he's telling us what the antidotes are. Okay, when we face obstacles, meditation on compassion. When we face other kind of obstacles, obstacles due to sentient beings, compassion. Other kinds of obstacles, emptiness. Okay, with some tantric empowerments that are given over a span of 2 days, at the end of the first day, they tell you to watch your dreams. What you dream that night before you do the actual empowerment the next day. So then the next day, coming to the teachings, everybody's excited. What did you dream? What did you dream? What did you dream? And everybody's talking about what they dreamed, what it possibly could mean. And then the first thing the Lama says when they start teaching that day, is dreams are only dreams. They are illusions. They did not happen. They are not real. And everybody goes, oh, you know, I had some fantastic dream. And yeah, it's really kind of interesting to see. Sometimes we meet people who have practiced for years and seem to have deep meditative experience, but act in ways that appear ethically questionable. When a contradiction exists between somebody's seemingly high realizations and their ethical conduct, that realization may not be as high as it seems. Although the ability to remain in single-pointed concentration or in non-conceptual states is a realization, it is not a very deep one. It is not a realization of emptiness, and the person is still afflicted by ignorance and karma. So even gaining single-pointed concentration, yeah, the mind is still under the influence of afflictions and karma, still in samsara. It's good to have that realization, but you've got to use it to meditate on emptiness or meditate on bodhicitta, not just to get blissed out. An actual realization, and here's the important part, an actual realization should bring about a change in our life. The sign of having gained the wisdom of studying the Dharma is that our outward behavior has become calm. Yeah, if you used to be a big mouth that made trouble for everybody and now you're calm, okay, that's showing that you're gaining the wisdom of studying the Dharma. Okay, and that kind of change is really valuable, isn't it? You know, if we used to just be super obnoxious and now we're much nicer, I mean, that helps us because we don't create so much negative karma. And it certainly helps all the people around us. And so that, you know, is actually much more practical than, you know, having a vision of this, that, and the other thing, but still being super obnoxious. The sign of having experientially realized the teachings of the middle level, you know, the practitioners of the middle level who strive for liberation from samsara. Okay, so the sign of having experientially realized those teachings is that our coarse afflictions have diminished in strength. That's good, isn't it? Yeah. People around us can notice that. If we meditate properly on bodhicitta, we become kinder human beings who are courageous in practicing the Dharma. In adversity, yogic meditators remain impartial, open, and compassionate. From such behavior, we can infer that they have subdued their minds through deep meditative experience. However, this alone is not an indication that they have realized emptiness directly. Okay? So there's many types of realizations, many levels of gaining realizations. Yeah? And so some of those you can see just because somebody's behavior has changed. And it's not just that, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so, you know, is usually raving mad, but today they were really kind. Oh, so they must have, you know, realized the realization of studying the Dharma. No, it has to be something consistent that lasts, you know, an actual change that lasts over a period of time. Okay, and then the reflection is, have you inadvertently fallen into any of the above pitfalls? What were the factors that led to this, and what must you do now to get back on track? And actually, there's another section before this chapter ends that's called Signs of Progress. So, if we devote our lives to familiarizing ourselves with the Dharma, we will definitely see a change in our mind. As a Buddhist saying predicts, you will be able to see the whole world and everything in it as Dharma instructions. Yeah, if you can do that, then your mind has really changed. Okay. This occurs when, through daily practice, our mind has become familiar with the Buddha's teachings, and we are able to practice in most of the situations we encounter. When we have gained some experience of impermanence, we are aware of things changing, arising, and ceasing in each moment. With this understanding prominent in our mind, our clinging to people and things that are unable to provide us lasting happiness decreases. Automatically, our mind is more relaxed and at ease. Okay. So I heard one friend who is an academic, a Buddhist academic, really excellent teacher, but an academic, you know, practices a little bit, but doesn't really consider himself a Buddhist. And he was telling me that another friend of his, who also an academic, who, you know, practices some, maybe a little bit, was saying that when his father died, Dharma didn't help him at all. Yeah? And I thought, oh, that's because those people were academics, you know, and they didn't really practice over time consistently so that they gained some familiarity with the Dharma. Yeah? Because if you have familiarity with the Dharma, especially if you've meditated on impermanence a lot, and you've thought of your dear ones dying, you've accepted it in your heart, you know that everything, you know, is changing and that whatever comes together separates, then, you know, when a dear one passes away, you don't freak out. Yeah, you may feel sad a bit, but you don't freak out. You're not hysterical. You're not depressed about the whole thing. Okay? So, yeah. So that's one thing, you know. You can see some people when a dear one, you know, regular people who don't practice, when a dear one dies, they're completely, I mean, yeah, out of control with grief. Yeah. If somebody's has practiced, you know, and they don't necessarily have realizations, but just some kind of familiarity with the teachings, then they know this is coming. They're able to accept it. Similarly, yeah, just to be able to accept change. We have a joke here at the Abbey that you make plans in the morning, and then an hour later, everything's changed, and you have to, you know, your whole list, what you were going to get done that day, out the window, and you have to adapt to whatever is happening. Yeah. So, you know, whether you can adapt or not adapt, that is depending on how familiar you are with the Dharma and with the teachings on impermanence. Yeah, if your mind isn't very familiar, if you haven't really taken impermanence to heart, then when you have your heart set on accomplishing something today and you don't get it done, it's like, well, okay, you know, it'll still be here tomorrow, you know. Whereas if you aren't familiar, then the mind gets very upset and, you know, oh, you know, there's always interference. Yeah. Okay. So just kind of, you know, how we are in daily life can show is indicative of our familiarity with the Dharma teachings. Yeah, when things don't turn out the way we want, you know, when people criticize us, you know, all these kinds of things, then, you know, how do we respond? How do we act? Do we fly off the handle? Do we, you know, completely retreat and become depressed? Yeah. So all this is affected by serious practice. Yeah, and so slowly you can, you know, we start to change. And so it's been very heartening to me. You know, some of the people who have known some of the older Dharma students here from way back, they tell me that they can really see the difference in them now since they've ordained and since they've been living at the Abbey. Yeah. And it's a good difference. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's good. When your friends and relatives can see some change in you, then that's good. And especially when your friends and your old friends and relatives, when they throw out those hooks that you used to get hooked by and you don't get hooked by them now, then it shows you're making progress. Yeah. You know how people throw hooks out and we bite them? Yeah. Do you ever throw hooks out at people? Oh, no, we don't do that. Okay, so with this understanding, prominent in our mind are clinging to people and things that are unable to provide us lasting happiness decreases. Automatically, our mind is more relaxed and at ease. When doing analytical meditation on the stages of the path, contemplate each point, considering it logically and relating it to your own experience. When thinking about these points, do not let the mind wander to objects of attachment or become sleepy or dull. Try to have a mind that is clear and concentrated, that stays on the points you are contemplating and is able to penetrate their meaning. I was just listening to an interview that somebody did with His Holiness. And His Holiness, the guy asked about meditation. And His Holiness said, you know, well, there's stabilizing meditation and there's analytic meditation. And I really prefer analytic meditation. You know, I want to analyze things and investigate them and how do things exist and so on. And the interviewer, who had started meditating before, said, like, oh, you know, I think most people, myself included, think that meditation is just clearing all the thoughts out of our mind. And His Holiness said, no, you know, you might have some kind of peaceful mind without a lot of thoughts, but that's not the realization of emptiness. Yeah. And so he again said how much he relies on analytic meditation to really understand the teachings and to apply them to his life. Yeah. Just last week, somebody was visiting us and we were talking about meditation. I said the same thing, you know, that His Holiness has said about just, you know, clearing the mind of thoughts isn't the purpose of meditation. And this woman was so surprised, and she said, wow, you just blew my whole idea of what I was doing in my practice away. Yeah. And it's true. I mean, I think many people broadly in society think the purpose of meditation is just to stop thinking. Yeah. And have some kind of peaceful blank state. So, you know, that does make you feel better. And that's fine, you know, there's nothing wrong with feeling better. But, you know, for a Buddhist practitioner, that's not what we're aiming at, you know. We're trying to really understand our situation in samsara, understand the teachings on how to generate love and compassion in bodhicitta, understand the nature of reality. And that involves really learning to think correctly and investigate. And of course, eventually we want to go beyond conceptual knowledge, okay? And we want to go into single-pointedness. But, you know, to start with, we have to learn what things, how, you know, we have to learn. Yeah, it's not just making our mind blank. Certain signposts along the path help us check whether our meditations are progressing in the right direction and bearing fruit. If we meditate consistently on how to rely on a spiritual mentor and come to a point where we do not pick faults in our spiritual teachers and feel genuine respect for their qualities and gratitude for their kindness, we have achieved a good result from this meditation. If we meditate on precious human life, so doing these analytical meditations on these topics, if we meditate on precious human life and have a stable feeling, my present life with so much freedom and opportunity to practice the path is difficult to receive and very precious. I do not want to waste it, but direct it towards familiarizing my mind with bodhicitta and emptiness. So if we have that kind of strong feeling, we are proceeding in the right direction. If we pay less attention to the happiness of this life and prepare for future lives, we are experiencing the result of meditation on impermanence. If acting destructively repulses us and we want to avoid it like poison, we have benefited from meditating on the sufferings of unfortunate rebirths. The mark of gaining experience of the meditation on refuge is that we understand the qualities of the three jewels and have deep trust in their ability to guide us on the path. Such feelings may arise during a meditation session, but the sign of real progress is when they occur repeatedly. Okay? So that's telling us what to look out for. How do we know we have generated true renunciation of cyclic existence? Yeah, we talk about the three principal aspects of the path. Yeah, renunciation of cyclic existence is the first one. Then bodhicitta, then the correct view of emptiness. So how do we know when we've generated renunciation of samsara and have an aspiration to attain liberation? Tsongkhapa says that when through habituation, day and night, we do not wish for the pleasures of cyclic existence and yearn for liberation, we have developed true determination to be free. Yeah. We may meditate on the disadvantages of samsara, and at the end of our meditation session have a really strong feeling like, enough, I've got to get out of samsara. And then you get up, and you go and make yourself a cup of tea, and it's like, well, I like my tea with so much sugar or so much honey and so much milk, and I like it exactly so it tastes like this, and I want this kind of cookie to eat with it, not this other kind of cookie. Yeah? So this happens all the time, doesn't it? You know, you have some strong feeling in meditation, and then you go out and, you know, it's gone. Yeah, somebody looks at you strangely and it's like, oh, they're criticizing me. How dare they? Yeah. And we just had this fantastic meditation about the kindness of sentient beings. Yeah. So this is very normal. You know, if this happens to you, that don't, you know, it's like after the ecstasy, the laundry. This is normal. So the thing to do when that happens, You know, if you have an especially strong experience, just be glad to know that that kind of experience is possible. Yeah. Try to keep it during the break time, but if you lose it, don't start criticizing yourself. Okay? Because this whole thing is so much a thing of habituation and familiarization. It's not a thing of like zap and like, wow, now I have renunciation. I am completely devoted to my spiritual practice. I don't care what kind of tea you give me anymore. Yeah, but the cookies, put them here. Yeah, okay. So, you know, just be happy to know that you that such experiences are possible, and to know that as you practice more and more and you become more and more familiar, then, you know, these experiences become more stable. Okay? That's all there is to it. There's no shortcut way. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, through habituation, day and night, you know, not like, oh, I'm so renounced during the day, but, oh, where's my soft bed? I want to lie down and go to sleep, you know, with my comforter at just the right temperature and my pillow fluffed up just enough. You know, but during the day, very renounced. Yeah, not like that, okay? So day and night, we do not wish for the pleasures of cyclic existence and yearn for liberation. We have developed true determination to be free. Such an attitude has ramifications in our life. We cease being obsessed with the pleasures of cyclic existence. And things that used to irritate us cease to do so. Yeah? So that person in the meditation hall who clears their throat all the time, they stop. You don't get bothered by it anymore. Okay. Do you realize this? Do you ever think about the things that drive you crazy? Yeah? It's like some people... They're wonderful people, but you can't stand them because they crack their fingers, yeah, or they're always zipping and unzipping their jacket, or, you know, they slurp when they eat, or they don't put their shoes, you know, next to each other but throw them, you know, these tiny things about people, and it drives us totally nuts, okay? So when you have... when we cease being obsessed with the pleasures of cyclic existence, those things stop irritating us. Okay? So you can see some sign of progress when certain things that used to drive you totally buggy stop driving you buggy. Okay? Yeah? When you used to be the person in the meditation hall who starts out like this, and as the meditation session goes on, you're checking out whether everybody else is meditating or not. Okay. That guy's fallen asleep. That one's leaning over. In meditation. I wonder if they have scoliosis. You know, why don't they sit up straight? They should sit up straight. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, yeah, that's what we do in our whole session. Yeah. Anybody do that? Yeah. Let's see. And then what's really embarrassing is you're checking out what everybody else is doing. and somebody else is doing the same thing, and you make eye contact. And then it's like, no, you really didn't see me with my eyes open looking around. You were hallucinating when you thought you saw that. I was concentrating. Okay. This does not mean, however, that in deep sleep we still aspire for liberation, for that is not possible. Nor is our determination to be free manifest when we are in deep concentration realizing emptiness. Nevertheless, it has not been lost. It is present but latent when our mind is focused on other objects. Okay. When we have realized bodhicitta, when through habituation and practice, you know, the great compassion and the aspiration to attain awakening arise spontaneously in our mind whenever we hear, see, or think about any sentient being. Great compassion and the aspiration to attain awakening arise spontaneously in your mind. Okay? Then you've realized bodhicitta. As explained in Tsongkhapa's three principal aspects of the path, which we will chant tomorrow after lunch. Yeah. The measure of having ascertained the correct view of emptiness is seeing that dependent arising and emptiness are not contradictory, but are mutually reinforcing, such that the mere reminder of dependent arising brings understanding of emptiness and vice versa. Okay, so the mere looking at something and considering it a dependent arising brings awareness of its emptiness. Woo! Yeah, not the judgmental mind of, you know, what guy did they make it black and, you know, just kind of old. No, that's, you know, we look at what arises when we look at this. Our judgmental mind. What is this used for? Why does it use? Oh, they got the other, you know, can I use it here? Can I use it here? Yeah, that thing, I don't know. Yeah? But instead of that kind of response, to look and to say, oh, dependent arising, empty. Yeah? Now, not just saying it with words, but really getting it. Okay? Generating virtuous qualities and realizations involves both undistracted focus and analytical discernment. Tsongkhapa says, therefore, the Buddha says that any achievement of a virtuous quality in the three vehicles requires a state of mind that is both, one, an actual serenity or a similitude of it, which rests one-pointedly on its virtuous object of meditation without wandering from it, and two, an actual insight or a similitude of it, which carefully analyzes a virtuous object of meditation and distinguishes both the real nature and the diversity of phenomena. So which can see that person's, that object's emptiness and their, the way they function, the way that object functions in the world. If we take good qualities and realizations to have similar meanings, serenity and insight, or mental states that are similar to them, are needed to gain these good qualities and realizations. This is certainly true for the realization of selflessness, which may be conceptual and inferential, for example, on the path of preparation, or direct and non-conceptual on the paths of seeing and meditation. For good qualities like renunciation, compassion, or bodhicitta to be definitively achieved, we need serenity or a state of one-pointedness like it. To realize selflessness, be it the conceptual inferential realization on the path of preparation or the direct non-conceptual realization on the path of seeing, both full serenity and insight are necessary. To realize selflessness before that, similitudes of serenity and insight are required. For those of us who would like to gain attainments quickly, this may seem like a high bar to reach. However, this description makes it clear that a realization is not a flash of understanding that comes and goes. It is a stable state of mind that can be sustained with undistracted focus. Unlike fleeting flashes that are difficult to replicate, the experiences from gradual cultivation can be generated repeatedly and enhanced through single-pointed concentration. Okay, and then on the reflections, what are realistic expectations for you on the path? And two, what can you do to accomplish them? And three, how can you keep a happy mind and cultivate patience while you go about creating the causes? Instead of getting impatient, wanting quick results, getting frustrated, comparing yourself to others, and, you know, you're sure that they've realized emptiness and we haven't. Others are always better than me and I'm always left out, you know. So instead of having that kind of reaction, continuing to persevere. Then chapter 11 is called Personal Reflections on the Path. And here His Holiness talks about his life and his experience. So the first section is called My Day. So what he does every day. People often ask me about my daily schedule and Dharma practice. I am a very poor practitioner, but I keep trying because I am convinced that practicing the Dharma is the path to peace and happiness. So look how he talks about himself. Yeah. And then you meet other people who go, oh, I've had really wonderful, you know, experiences in my meditation. And, you know, I'm very close to having serenity. And yeah. And then His Holiness says, oh, I'm a very poor practitioner. And here's this guy, you know, next to His Holiness. Oh, I, you know, this. You know, it's the distinction is quite marked. Anyway, you notice it. Okay. In Dharamsala, India, where I live, I wake up at 3:30 a.m. and immediately visualize the Buddha and recite a verse of homage written by Nagarjuna. So this is from the Nagarjuna's Karikas. Enthused by great compassion, you taught the exalted Dharma to dispel all wrong views. To you, Gotama, I prostrate. That's the verse he recites immediately when he wakes up. Sometimes I change the last line of the verse to say, may I be inspired by Gotama Buddha. This verse is especially meaningful to me because it points out that the Buddha's compassionate motivation that led him to identify ignorance as the cause of dukkha, or unsatisfactory experiences, and then to attain the wisdom realizing the ultimate nature to dispel that ignorance. Okay? So it was his compassionate motivation that led him to understand all of that. Ignorance is not a mere lack of knowledge. It is a distorted apprehension that grasps as things, that grasps as existing what does not exist, inherent existence. Okay, so inherent existence does not exist at all. We grasp it as existing. We think everything's inherently existing. Bodhicitta then spurred him, the Buddha, to accumulate merit, purify his mind, and hear, think, and meditate on the Dharma. In that way, he became an awakened teacher with the ability to liberate sentient beings by giving faultless teachings. Those of you who study Chapter 2 in Pramanavartika, are you hearing an echo of what you studied in that last, these last few sentences? Dharmakirti, in his text Pramanavartika, goes through an argument of the Buddha's qualities that show why he is a reliable guide on the path. Reflecting in this way increases my confidence in the Buddha and in the path that I practice to transform my mind. It also helps me to appreciate my precious human life with many fortunate qualities. I live in a place and time where the Buddha has appeared and his teachings still exist, and I have belief in things worthy of respect, such as ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. Recalling this daily enables me to maintain a joyful attitude immune to depression and discouragement. Yeah. So you see, His Holiness gives himself credit for what he does. You know, I have a belief in things worthy of respect, such as ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. And he sees that and he realizes what a fortunate life he has. Yeah. He doesn't say, oh, you know, yeah, there's ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, but I break my precepts. I can't concentrate worth beans, and I'm totally ignorant, so the whole path is hopeless. Yeah? So, you know, we can look at the same thing from one perspective and make ourselves discouraged, and we can look at the same thing from another perspective and feel like, wow, I am the most important, the most fortunate person in this universe. And it's looking at the same thing. Okay? So this is important, you know, to really encourage ourselves on the path, to see our, you know, the incredible opportunity that we have and to rejoice at it. And, you know, His Holiness is saying, you know, I'm rejoicing because I even have belief in these things. Yeah, we may say, well, you believe it. Yeah, so what? Big deal. You don't practice. But, you know, what about, isn't there a difference between the a person who believes in the value of ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, and the person who believes in the value of cheating and deceiving other people? Yeah? Okay, so just what we believe in, there's, you know, makes a big difference in who we are. So we should give ourselves credit just for having, you know, correct, you know, beneficial values and correct views, instead of always, oh, I'm so deficient, somebody else is better than me, you know. There's no time for that kind of whining. Death is approaching and our life is too short, you know, so why spend our life whining? It just doesn't make any sense. Okay? So after reciting this verse 3 times, His Holiness says, I visualize Buddha Vajradhara dissolving into me and inspiring my mind. This gives me a feeling of courage and the willingness to persevere in my practice. I then generate bodhicitta and remind myself that I can surely see transformation happening within myself, although it may be small. This is what he does every day when he wakes up. He reminds himself that I can surely see transformation happening within myself, although it may be small. Okay. This encourages me to rejoice in my virtue and continue practicing. So you see how he takes care of his own mind and maintains his mind in a positive state. Yeah. And this is somebody who became a refugee when he was 24 years old. Okay. To clear the fogginess of sleep from my mind, I recite Manjushri's mantra, Omarapatanadi, and then recite D as many times as possible with one breath, imagining Manjushri's wisdom in the form of the syllable D absorbing into a D at the back of my tongue. So it's Omarapatanadi, Omarapatanadi, and you keep saying D until you run out of air, and you imagine that all these D's is Manjushri's seed syllable are absorbing into the seed syllable D back at the back of your mouth, you know, where the you don't want the dentist to poke. Okay. While meditating on Manjushri like this, I reflect on the four truths of the Aryas, especially the liberating power of true paths and the peace that comes with actualizing true cessations. So he thinks about that first thing in the morning, plus bodhicitta. So he really makes his mind, you know, immerses his mind in the Dharma from the very get-go. Yeah, he doesn't kind of roll over and go, oh, what do I have to do today? Oh, I have appointments all day. Oh, I wonder what my schedule, you know, my attendance is scheduled. All these people coming in with their problems. I'm so sick of it. No, that's not what he thinks when he first wakes up. Yeah? He, you know, imbues his mind with the Dharma and encourages himself. Then I begin prostrations and daily recitations, followed by glance meditation, in which I recite and contemplate verses sequentially outlining the complete stages of the path to awakening. Okay, so he does some prostrations. Then he does daily recitations, you know, like we do, you know, when we do the practice of the Buddha, or, you know, just our daily practice. Recitations, and a glance meditation. So a glance meditation is a short text, usually just a few pages long, that has verses, and each verse covers one of the main topics in the stages of the path to awakening. So like the three principal aspects of the path that we'll chant tomorrow after lunch is a glance meditation. Yeah. If you look in the blue prayer book, there's another one, the foundation of all good qualities. Okay, that's a glance meditation. In the Lama Chopa text, after we offer soak, the lengthy prayer there is a glance meditation. What we recite on Wednesdays, the parting from the four clingings, is a glance. So 37 practices on Monday and parting from four clingings on Wednesday and no, not the four mindfulness. That's a tantric. And three principal aspects of the path on Saturday. Those are all glance meditations, okay? Okay. After that, I do formal meditation, predominantly analytical meditation to increase my understanding of the Buddha's teachings. Here, my efforts are mainly directed to meditation on dependent arising and emptiness, as well as on compassion and bodhicitta. I also do the tantric practice of deity yoga, which involves imagining transforming death, the intermediate state between one life and the next, and rebirth into the three bodies of a Buddha. So that's his morning practice. He's woken up at 3:30. I continue meditating, taking a few breaks, including breakfast and exercise, and he also listens to the BBC, until about 8:30 in the morning. Okay. If there is no office work, which is hardly ever, then I study Dharma texts. I take delight in reading the Indian and Tibetan treatises and commentaries repeatedly, each time discovering something new in them. There's a Tibetan saying, if you read a book 9 times, you will have 9 understandings. Because this has been my experience, I will continue studying until the end of my life and recommend that others do as well. So one of our hopes with this series of books, you know, the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, is that it becomes one of those books, not only that teachers teach their students from in the West, but that Westerners study repeatedly again and again and really go through, you know, because it's really true. Every time you read something, it means something different to you. Often my study is interrupted because I am needed in the office. Lunch is just before noon. I think he usually eats around 11 or 11:30 if he can. And after that, I go to the office to work. My afternoons are filled with appointments, one right after the other. And having been there, having had appointments with His Holiness, it really is like that, you know? It's like you are waiting in the waiting room when the attendant senses that the current interview is finishing. They signal for the next people to stand up. You collect your things. You stand at the doorway. When the other people come out, they push you in right away. You know, it's like, you know, hurry, 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 you know, because sometimes you have to walk a distance like from here to here, you know, where you exit one room and go into the room where His Holiness is. It's like, hurry, hurry, hurry. Yeah. So that's what it's like. It's really for him, one person right after the other, or one group of people right after the other. Yeah. It's quite amazing how it happens. Yeah. He doesn't take a break and go, oh, shrew, glad that one's done. You know? He just is like greeting everybody with joy. Okay. As a Buddhist monk, I don't eat dinner. And around 8:30 p.m., I go to sleep. I sleep very soundly without any sleeping pills and enjoy very peaceful meditation. So he meditates while he's asleep. One teaching of the Kadampa masters called the Four Entrustments especially touches my heart. And here's the verse. Entrust your mind to Dharma practice. Entrust your Dharma practice to a life of poverty. Entrust your life of poverty to death. And entrust your death to an empty cave. Okay, so entrust your mind to Dharma practice. Yeah, just put your whole heart and your whole mind into the practice. And then entrust your Dharma practice to a life of poverty. You appreciate the Dharma so much, you respect it and want to actualize it so much, that wealth does not matter. You don't worry about wealth. You don't worry about having enough money for clothes and all this kind of stuff. Okay, you just, yeah, you entrust your Dharma practice to a life of poverty. Yeah, it doesn't mean you don't take care of yourself, but, you know, you take care of yourself, but you have no interest in, you know, having a nice wardrobe with the latest fashion and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Entrust your life of poverty to death. So you're living a simple lifestyle, really practicing well, and knowing that one day you will die. And you accept that. And entrust your death to an empty cave. Yeah. So if you die alone, you're totally happy. Yeah. You don't want to die with a bunch of people around you and your family holding your hand and saying, I love you and don't leave me. You know, you just want to be able to do your Dharma practice when you die and not be disturbed. So, an empty cave. These lines speak of completely giving ourselves to the cultivation of the two bodhicittas, conventional and ultimate, making this the most important activity in our lives, so much so that we are willing to give all our lives' energies to it from now until our death. Relinquishing attachment to the eight worldly concerns, our mind experiences so much joy and satisfaction with the freedom the Dharma bestows that money and reputation are of no concern to us. Because your mind is so blissful through the practice. You know, you don't worry about other people, what other people think about you. You don't worry about your retirement fund. You don't worry about whether you're going to get invited to somebody's wedding. You don't worry about your job, if you're going to lose your job. All of that is just gone, you know, because your mind is completely dedicated. You are completely dedicated to training and transforming your mind. Yeah, and so that's what you spend your time and energy doing. And as you do it, your mind becomes so peaceful. Yeah, totally peaceful that none of this other stuff that seems so tantalizing is in the least bit interesting anymore. Yeah, must be incredible to have that kind of mental state. When I reflect on this verse, tears come to my eyes because this is my highest aspiration. It also reflects the great challenge in my life, balancing meditative cultivation with directly benefiting others in this life. Both are aspects of Dharma practice and our inner development. The pressing needs of people right now are very important, but meditative practice beckons, and the need to deepen my own practice in order to benefit others more is also essential. Perhaps some of you live with this tension in your lives too. I think, shouldn't speak for you, but I think some people, our tension is between getting the kitchen and getting to the cushion and the eight worldly concerns. Okay? It's not between meditation and benefiting sentient beings. That would be progress for us if that were where our attention was. Occasionally, I am able to do a retreat. During this time, I practice the visualization of deities and mandalas and the recitation of mantras. But mainly, I read and contemplate the great Indian texts. Being able to study and reflect on the meaning of these magnificent texts is a great treat for me.
Do you have any idea which glance meditation that His Holiness uses in the morning?
I'm sure he does Lama Chopa every day. Yeah. So he may do other glance meditations as well, but for sure he does Lama Chopa, the whole thing.
So someone online asks, Carl Jung pointed out the power of working with dreams as a gateway to bring the unconscious to the conscious mind. Is this in opposition to the Buddhist point of view?
I don't know. They're two very different fields, you know. One is psychology, and psychology has its own goals, and another is Buddhism, which has its own goals. So I really can't comment on that.
When His Holiness was talking about his daily practice, and he made the distinction between doing the recitations and the glance meditation and then going into formal practice with the analytic meditation. I found that distinction interesting because often maybe we'll stop and do the analytic meditation during the glance meditation, but he seems to be separating the recitations from the formal practice.
The recitations, he also means seven, you know, taking refuge, generating bodhicitta, seven then prayer, mandalas, and things like that. So you always do those practices, you know, of refuge and bodhicitta, accumulating merit, purifying. You always do those before the analytic meditations. Yeah. In terms of, usually you would do an analytic meditation and then a glance meditation and then your analytic meditation. There's two ways to do that. One is you do the whole glance meditation, then you do the analytic. Another is you do the glance meditation up to a certain verse, then you do analytic meditation on that verse, then you continue the rest of the glance meditation. So you can do it either way. What it'll come to next time, we'll talk about the rest of the day and what he does in the evening, reviewing the day and so on. So that's coming.
I think it's really wonderful that His Holiness has made it so apparent that whatever we consider him to be version of high status or fame or whatever, his practice is pretty much everything that we have been instructed to do as well. There's nothing spectacular, nothing unique about it. Basically does what we all have been instructed to do. So that's really important.
He practices what he preaches. Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, and he preaches what he practices because he knows it works.
Friends in Singapore say that some friend told us that taking deities or bodhisattvas' empowerment is a way to remind us of the value of compassion and courage of the deities. With this intention, is it okay to take such empowerment?
Before you take empowerments, there's different kinds of empowerments. First of all, you should have a good understanding of the stages of the path to awakening and of the three principal aspects of the path. You should have a good understanding of that. You should have refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay. And then there's different levels of empowerment, so you should see what level it is. Don't start out when you're a baby beginner taking the highest yoga tantra. You start out with the simpler practices. Then you inquire what are the precepts and commitments that are involved in receiving the empowerment, because with all of them, you take the bodhisattva vow. With some of them, you also take the tantric vow. So you should find out what you're going to be committing yourself to. You should also find out if there's a daily recitation requirement, because some lamas want you to recite a mantra a certain number of times, or that you may have a requirement to do a retreat that lasts for a few weeks or sometimes even months, or you may have a requirement to recite a whole sadhana. So you need to investigate what the practice is, what level it is, are you prepared, what are the commitments, And then you decide. And you take the initiation because you want to do the practice. Okay? Not just so that you get some blessed water or, you know, they hit you on the head with something or give you a pill.
Would you be willing to go through your day at some point? Your meditation practice?
Maybe. Not now.